Chapter 7. When Chalmers Ching request arrived the following morning, Sunday found herself putting down the coffee pot with a highly specific sense of dread. She accepted the bind with a profound and familiar foreboding.
"I have some news," Chalmers said. "Probably the kind I ought to break to you first, so you can come round to my side and explain things to the others."
"This is going to turn out to have something to do with last night's conversation, isn't it?"
Boots tramped on metal flooring outside. Someone knocked on the door vigorously.
"Brother," Sunday called, "can you get that one for me?"
Jeffrey went up to the door and returned to the kitchen with Gleb. The zookeeper looked harried.
"This is not good," he said.
"Chama,"
Sunday asked the figment,
"why are you chinging in from outside the zone?"
"Because, given my current circumstances, it would be very difficult to ching in from anywhere else."
Chama was strapped into a heavy black seat, sunk deep in its padded embrace. He wore the brass-coloured body part of a modern ultralight spacesuit, with a helmet stowed elsewhere.
"You're aboard a spacecraft," Sunday said.
The tag coordinates were updating constantly. The last few digits a tumbling blur.
"Chama, why are you aboard a spacecraft? Ever heard of striking while the iron's hot?"
"This is very bad," Gleb said, wedging his earpiece into place. "Sunday, work me figment privilege, please. I want to be able to see and talk to him as well."
Sunday already knew the answer to her next question, but she asked it anyway.
"Chama, are you planning something that might upset the Chinese?"
"That's the general drift of things," Chama said,
while Sunday voked the Ching settings to allow everyone else to join in the conversation.
"Your husband is here," Sunday said. "He's not happy." "Gleb, I'm sorry, but this wasn't something we could sit around and discuss. You've always been more cautious than me. You'd have told me to put it off until later to give it time to settle in."
"For good reason," Gleb shouted. "Had to be now or never. Look, I talked it over with the Pans in Tiamat. I have tacit authorization. They'll bail me out whatever happens."
"You mean they'll give it their best shot?"
"They're very, very good at this sort of thing, Gleb. Everything's going to be fine."
"Whose ship is that?" Sunday asked. "And how secure is this Ching bind?"
"The ship's Pan registered," Chama said. "It's a short-range hopper, barely has the delta V to pull itself out of lunar gravity, but perfectly fine for ballistic transfers and the occasional illicit touchdown. We've used it many times."
"And the bind?"
she persisted.
"Quangled. So it's very unlikely anyone's going to be listening in, even the Chinese. Of course, they'll be trying, but it'll take a while to unravel the quanglement, and we have surplus paths lined up."
He flashed a grin.
"All the same, you should still know what you're dealing with. Basically, I'm about to do something very naughty indeed."
"No," Sunday said. "We should never have discussed this, not even as an outside possibility. It was an idea, Chama, not a binding commitment."
"Want to join in? There's enough capacity on this path to handle a few piggybackers."
"This is a Kenya business," Jeffrey said. "It's nothing to do with you."
"Stop being a Kenya business when the two of you blabbed about it, elephant boy. Anyway, I'm doing you miserable, self-absorbed Akinyas a favor by putting my neck on the block here."
Chalmers Figment glanced to one side as a recorded voice began talking in a firm but not unfriendly voice.
"Oh, here we go. First alert. Just a polite request to alter my course. Nothing too threatening yet. I haven't even crossed the coast wall."
"Turn around now," Sunday said.
"Bit late for that, I'm afraid. Locked myself out of the avionics. Couldn't change course if I wanted to."
"That's insane," she answered.
"Nope, just very, very determined. Oh, wait. Second warning. Sterner this time. Notification of countermeasures and reprisals." "Gosh, isn't that exciting?"
His figment reached up and grasped the helmet that had been out of sight until then.
"I'm not expecting them to shoot me out of the sky.
Be silly not to take precautions, though. He lowered the helmet to within a few centimeters of its neck ring and let the docking magnet snatch it home, the helmet and ring engaging with a series of rapid clunks and whirs. Save for a swan-necked column curving up from the nape to the crown, the helmet was transparent.
But you can come with me, Sunday, all of you can!
Charma tapped commands into the chunky, rubber-sealed button pad on his gauntlet cuff.
Be quick about it, though. Not going to have all the time in the world here, even if they let me get to the burial spot. Oh, I can see the ghost wall now. It's very impressive. It's very Chinese. Does anyone else maintain a consensual border hallucination, even halfway as impressive?
Sunday cut in on Sharma's monologue.
What you were saying about this being untraceable, are you absolutely 100% sure about that?
No, Charma said, giving a visible shrug through the tight-fitting suit. How could I be? But you're in the zone, Sunday. Power blocks like the Chinese hate the zone precisely because they can't backtrack signals all the way to their source. And the fact that they loathe and detest us for that is the best possible guarantee I can give that they're not along for the ride. So live a little. Ching out with me.
Did you bring proxies?
Gleb asked.
Two, all I could squeeze in. The rest of you can go passive.
Sunday hadn't thought about proxies.
We're going to have words about this when you get back, she said.
Spoken like a true friend. Third warning!
Charma's figment jolted violently as if, in ignorance of the absence of atmosphere, his ship had hit clear air turbulence.
Interesting, Charma said,
his voice coming through distinctly even with the helmet on.
They're trying to wrestle control from my own avionics. Interesting, but not remotely good enough. Going to have to up their game if they want to get anywhere.
The ship settled down. Sunday inhaled a deep breath.
Give me a few moments.
I'm not going anywhere, Charma said. Couldn't you have stopped this? She demanded of Gleb.
He was up and out of our apartment before I realized what was going on. You think I actually approve of this?
She cooled her anger. Taking it out on the other zookeeper wasn't the right thing to do. All of a sudden, she realized how hard this must be for Gleb. With his husband out there, taunting the most powerful national entity on the moon.
Well, there are four of us and two proxies, Jitendra said. I'll go passive. Gleb can take one of the machines.
I'll manage without embodiment, Gleb said. If I had arms and legs, I might be tempted to strangle someone.
If there's any treasure under that soil, Jeffrey said, looking at his sister, it belongs to us. I guess you and I ought to have bodies.
There were four open Qing binds, two for proxy embodiment, two for passive Qing. Sunday assigned one of the proxy binds to herself, leaving the other for Jeffrey. Jitendra and Gleb could take care of their own binds.
I'm going in, she said. The rest of you better be there when I arrive.
She voked for Qing. For a moment, one that was far too familiar to be distressing, she felt her soul sliding out of her body, not in any specific direction, but in all directions at once. As if she was an image of herself that was losing focus, smearing into quantum haze. That was the neuromachinery taking hold, shunting sensory and proprioceptive inputs to the waiting robot halfway around the moon. And then everything was sharp again and she was somewhere else, in a different body, in a hurtling spacecraft that had just transgressed the sovereign airspace of the special lunar autonomous region of the People's Republic of China. She was strapped to a wall mounting, facing Charma.
I'm here, Sunday said. Now, what do I have to do to get you to turn this ship around?
I already told you,
Charma said, angling his glassy visor to look at the proxy.
There's nothing to be done now except enjoy the trip.
Sunday felt pinned inside something that didn't quite fit her body, as if she'd been forced into a stiff, partially rusted suit of armor. Then something gave, something relaxing in her brain, and the final transition to embodiment occurred. She studied her new anatomy. The cheapest kind of mass-produced Aeroflot unit, little more than an android chassis, all metallic blue tubing and bulbous universal joints. She was a mechanical stick figure, like a hydraulic car jack that had decided to unfold itself and walk upright. To her right, another proxy started moving. It was metallic red, but otherwise very similar. It looked at Charmer, then at Sunday. The head was an angular pineapple, faceted with wraparound sensors and caged in alloy crash bars.
"Well," said Jeffrey, "I'm here."
And he moved one of the arms, lifting it up to examine the wrist and hand and elegant, dexterous human configuration fingers and thumb. Jeffrey's actions were wooden, but that would soon wear off. It wasn't as if her brother had never ridden a proxy before. He was just out of practice.
"Where exactly are we?" Sunday asked Jama.
"Good question," Jeffrey said, to be quickly followed by, "What the hell are we doing here, and why am I involved?"
"Well inside Chinese sovereign airspace," Jama said, "descending over Pythagoras 55 Ks from the burial spot. We should be there in about 6 minutes.
Sunday appraised her surroundings. She'd been in bigger shower cubicles. The hopper was about as small as spacecraft got before they stopped being spacecraft and became escape pods or very roomy spacesuits.
"Whatever's under the soil," Jeffrey said. "It's not your concern, Charmer."
The ship bucked and swayed again, the golems clattering in their wall restraints. Charmer cursed and worked the manual joystick set into the armrest of his chair, jerking it violently until the ride smoothed out.
"They're cunning," he said. "I'll give them that. Found a back door into the command software even I didn't know about."
"I thought you said you didn't have manual control," Sunday said.
"We'll talk about it afterwards," Charmer said again. "Where are Gleb and Jitendra, by the way?"
Jitendra's head and upper torso popped into existence in the cabin.
"Here. And me," Gleb added.
"Took your sweet time arriving," Sunday said.
"Bandwidth was tighter than you said," Jitendra replied. "Kept being put on hold."
"That's the Chinese," Charmer said. "Trying to break the Quangle paths or squeeze us on bandwidth."
"They can do that?" Sunday asked.
"Not difficult if you're a government. Diplomatic priority transmissions, that kind of thing. Flood the bandwidth with a pipeload of government-level signals that must be routed ahead of routine traffic. It's very clever."
Sunday caught a smile through Charmer's helmet.
"Fortunately, we have some even cleverer people on our side. Uh-oh."
"What in this context," Jeffrey said, "does uh-oh mean?"
"Means I've just been given my final warning," Charmer said happily. "Border enforcement interceptors are on their way."
"Could be a bluff," Sunday said.
"Except that radar also has incoming returns, heading our way. Moving too quickly to be crewed vehicles. Probably just armed drones."
"Armed drones," Jeffrey said. "I can't tell you how good that makes me feel."
"And deterrence," Charmer replied dismissively, as if he'd said something very naive. "That's all it'll be. No one shoots things down anymore. We're not on Earth now."
An impact warning started to blare. Those parts of the walling not taken up with windows, instruments, and equipment modules began to strobe scarlet. Sunday saw Jitendra and Gleb flicker and vanish, and almost immediately felt puppet strings striving to yank her back into her own body in the de-scrutinized zone. She was there for a heartbeat, standing up in her living room, in the middle of domestic clutter. Then she was back in the hopper, and her friends had returned as well.
"Okay," Charmer said. "Change of plan. I'm taking us in steeper and harder than I was intending. This is all good fun, isn't it?"
"I'm in the middle of a major diplomatic incident," Jitendra said, marveling. "This was so not in my plans for the day when I woke up this morning."
"You're not in the middle of anything," Charmer corrected. "You're observing. There's nothing they'll be able to pin on you for that." "Oh, please, shut up!"
He was talking to the hopper. It silenced its alarms and ceased strobing its warning lights. Lunar surface scrolled past with steadily increasing speed as the vehicle lost altitude. Though it was day over Pythagoras, the crater's high altitude meant that the shadows remained ink black and elongated, There was little sign that people had ever come to this pumice grey place. No glints of metal or plastic signifying habitation, or even the arduous toiling of loyal machines. But there were tracks, against the ancient talcum of the surface. Footprints and vehicle marks were immediately obvious to the eye. On Earth, they might have been taken for lava flows or dried-up riverbeds. On the moon, they could only mean that something had perambulated or walked there. Sunday had to adjust her preconceptions when she realized that the curiously stuttered vehicle tracks she was trying to make sense of were in fact footprints, and that the hopper was merely hundreds of meters above the moon's surface rather than several kilometers. They had come down much faster than she thought.
"There it is!" Charmer said, pointing ahead. "The place where your granny came back. See the scuffed up ground?"
"I can't see anything," Sunday said.
"Voke out the hopper. You have authorization."
Sunday issued the command. It hadn't occurred to her before, and most of the hopper vanished. All that remained was a neon sketch of its basic outline. A three-dimensional wedge-shaped prism with Charmer cradled somewhere near the middle. The golems and Gleb and Jitendra's disembodied heads and torsos were flying along for the ride. And now she could indeed see the disturbed ground where Eunice had returned, some unguessable interval after her long walk from the 2059 crash site. Everything was the same as the aerial image Jitendra had shown them in the ISS. The touchdown marks from another ship, the hairpin of footprints where someone had crossed to Eunice's original trail and then headed back to the ship. The area of dug-up regolith, like a patch of dirt where a horse had rolled on its back. Nothing else. Nothing to suggest that anyone had beaten them to this place.
"This is where it gets interesting," Charmer said.
"Here come the interceptors!"
Sunday tensed. She wasn't in any conceivable danger, but Charmer's confidence might well be misplaced. It had been decades since any kind of lethal state-level action had occurred between two spacefaring powers. But that didn't mean it couldn't happen again, given sufficient provocation.
"How many?" Gleb asked.
"Three,"
Charmer said.
"What I expected. Small autonomous drones, demon-cloaked. You want to see them? I can override the Chinese org if you don't, but they've gone to so much trouble. Almost be a shame not to."
The drones came in fast, swerving at the last instant to avoid ramming the hopper. In their uncloaked form, they were too fast and fleet to make out as anything other than bright moving sparks. They might have weapons or they might rely purely on their swiftness and agility to ram any moving object. Whatever they were, beyond any reasonable doubt, they were rigorously legal. They might be operating within Chinese sovereign airspace, but they would still need to abide by the wider non-proliferation treaties governing all spacefaring entities. There was, however, nothing to stop them projecting fearsome org layers around themselves. The demon cloaks made them look much larger than the hopper. Each was a grinning, ghoulish head, styled in Chinese fashion, trailing banners of luminous fire behind it. As the drones whipped around the descending hopper, harassing it, but never quite coming into contact, their fire tails dangled into a whirling, multicolored corkscrew. One demon was pale, sickly green, another frigid blue. The third was the liverish red of a slavering tongue. Their eyes were white and wild, furious under beetle brows. They looked like Pekingese dogs turned rabid and spectral.
"Cease your descent," a voice said, cutting across the cabin. "Do not attempt to land. You will be escorted back to neutral lunar airspace. Immediate failure to cooperate will be construed as hostile action. Hostile action will be countered with sanctioned military force."
The corkscrewing demons were getting closer now, spiraling ever tighter around the hopper.
"Do what they say,"
Gleb pleaded.
"Just words," Charmer said. "Nothing I wasn't expecting."
But at the same time, he reached up and touched his neck ring, as if to reassure himself that the helmet really was engaged and pressure tight.
"Cease your descent," the voice said again. "This is your final warning."
"I think they mean it,"
Sunday said.
They're bluffing. Last thing they want to do is shoot down some idiot tourist who just happened to key the wrong coordinates into their autopilot.
I think by now they probably realize they're not dealing with an idiot tourist, Jeffrey said.
Guess that's possible, Charmer admitted.
The blue demon rammed the hopper. As the demon veered away, apparently undamaged, the hopper went into a slow tumble. Charmer released the joystick, letting the avionics stabilize the vehicle. They didn't do much good. Just as the hopper was regaining orientation and control, another demon would come in and knock it back into a tumble. The knocks were becoming more violent, and the ground was rushing up towards them like the bottom of an elevator shaft. The demons were coming in two and three at a time now, jackhammering against the hull. The tumble was totally uncontrolled, the ground spinning in and out of view several times a second. Charmer started saying something. It might have been brace, but Sunday couldn't be sure. All she knew was that an instant later, Charmer wasn't there. Where the seat had been was an impact cocoon, a cushioned, mushroom-white adaptive shell that had enveloped both the seat and its occupant in an eye blink. Everything went blank. There was a moment of limbo, and then she was back in her apartment again. Only for another moment, though. The ching bind had been interrupted but not severed. She fell back into the golem, and the golem was out of its harness, lying in a limb-knotted tangle against one of the equipment modules on the opposite wall. The hopper was back to solidity now, no longer a neon sketch of itself. Jitendra's head and torso phased in and out of view, cross-hatched with cartoon static to indicate bandwidth compression. Gleb flickered. Jeffrey's golem was hanging out of its harness. That went well, Charmer said. The impact cocoon had folded itself away and Charmer was unbuckling upside down. He dropped, at lunar acceleration, onto what had been the ceiling. Jitendra resumed solidity. Jeffrey extricated his golem from its harness. Sunday tried to move her own proxy body and found her blue metal limbs working normally.
They took us out, she said amazed. Tactical disablement, Charmer replied, thoroughly nonplussed. Very well done, too. We're still airtight, and the collision was within survivability parameters.
He grabbed a yellow handhold and propelled himself across to the hopper's door.
Hold on, I'm venting. No point in saving the air now.
The air fled the hopper in a single dying bark, dragging with it a fluff cloud of silvery dust and spangling human detritus. Moving in vacuum now, Charmer operated the door's bulky release mechanism. The door opened onto a view like a late Rothko. Rectangle of black sky below, rectangle of dazzling bright lunar ground above. The golem's vision system dropped software filters over the scene until the ground dimmed to a tolerable grey. Charmer was first out. He sprang through the corridor and fell to the surface, landing cat-like. Sunday followed, Charmer already bounding to the other side of the hopper by the time her golem touched dirt. Sunday looked back just as Jeffrey's machine spidered out of the upturned hopper, followed closely by the bobbing balloon-like head and shoulders of Jitendra's figment, and then Gleb's. Jitendra and Gleb were merely moving viewpoints, entirely dependent on Charmer and the golems to supply their chingbinds with a constantly updating environment. The demon-cloaked drones were still swarming overhead, circling and helixing above the spot where Charmer had crashed.
This way, he said, breaking into a seven-league sprint, flinging his arms wide with each tiresome stride. Can't be too far north of where we came down.
The golems, built for durability rather than speed, had difficulty keeping up with the bounding figure. Charmer had a spade strapped to the back of his suit, of the perfectly mundane communal garden type. He must have put it in one of the hopper's external stowage lockers, ready to grab as soon as they were down. There was something else, too. A grey alloy cylinder, tucked under his life support backpack. Some new order must have reached the demons, for they aborted their spiraling flight and rocketed away in three directions, streaking across the crater wall that marked the effective horizon. But they were not leaving. A kilometer or so away, they whipped around and came back, streaking at man height, across the crater floor, demon cloak faces tipped forward, eyes glaring, tongues rabid and drooling. They screamed and howled through the orc.
Keep moving, Charmer called. This is just intimidation. They won't touch us.
I certainly feel adequately intimidated, Jitendra said. Sunday flinched as the red demon blocked her path, its dog-like face as wide as a house. The cloak was nebulous. Through its billowing, flaming translucence, she made out the hovering kernel of the drone, balanced on spiking microjets.
Do not move, said the same commanding voice that they had heard in the hopper. You are under arrest. You will remain in this area for processing by border enforcement officials.
Keep moving, Charmer said again.
Charmer had his own demon intent on blocking his progress, the blue one. Charmer wasn't stopping, though, and the demon was actually backing up, not letting itself get too close to what it undoubtedly registered as a warm, breathing, easily damaged human presence. The green demon was fixating on Jeffrey. None of them was paying any attention at all to Jitendra or Gleb, their figments all but undetectable. Some governing intelligence had already determined that these were disposable machines. The monstrous face leered and glared as it anticipated Sunday's movements, ducking and diving to either side like a keen goalkeeper. Then, without warning, the demon cloaks vanished. A man was standing in front of her now, hands clasped behind his back, with the hovering drone at his rear. He wore a neat, platinum-grey business suit of modern cut over a white shirt and pearl necktie. His shoes failed to merge with the soil, their soles hovering a centimetre or so above the dirt. He was young, handsome, and plausible.
Good morning, the man said, agreeably enough. I am Mr. Pei, from the Department of Border Control. Would you be so kind as to remain where you are until this matter can be resolved? Officials will be with you very shortly.
Another copy of Mr. Pei had appeared in front of Jeffrey, presumably reciting the same spiel. There might be a real human being behind these figments, or it might still be some kind of automated response.
I don't think so, Mr. Pei, Sunday said.
Whatever trouble she was in now, she reckoned, couldn't be made much worse by trying to keep up with Charmer. She made another effort to slip past the drone.
I must insist, Mr. Pei said.
His voice was firm but pleasant, his words tempered with a regretful smile.
Please let me past.
Mr. Pei still had his hands behind his back.
I must ask you not to compound matters by disobeying a perfectly reasonable request. As I said, the border officials will be here very shortly, and then processing and debriefing may commence. Would you be so good as to give me your name and location? At the moment, we can't localize you more precisely than the de-scrutinized zone.
Then I don't think I'll bother, thanks.
It would be in your ultimate interests. Your accomplice will be detained shortly. Any assistance you can give us now will be taken into consideration when we evaluate the penalties for your trespass.
He smiled again, bringing his hands around to beckon for her cooperation.
Who are you, though? And where are you chinging from?
We will discover these things in due course, so you may as well tell us now.
I'm afraid you'll have to join the dots yourself, Mr. Pei. Is that an unequivocal statement of non-cooperation? It sounded like one, didn't it? Very well.
Mr. Pei looked over his shoulder and nodded. The drone shot through him, straight at the golem. It tore off an arm and blasted the rest of the golem into the soil, where it lay, twitching and useless. There was no pain, just an abrupt curtailment of sensory feedback. For a moment, Sunday was looking up at the sky until Mr. Pei loomed into view again, bowing over her.
I regret that it was necessary to take this action, but you gave us no choice.
The drone pushed through him and spun until its gun barrel was pointed straight down at her useless body. The muzzle flashed, then everything went black. She expected to return to the stack module. Instead, her point of view shifted to Charmer's, looking down at a pair of gauntleted hands scooping aside lunar soil with the plastic-handled garden spade. Charmer was kneeling, breathing heavily. He had commenced his excavation in the middle of the area of disturbed ground and had already cut a trench big enough for a body. The suit would be assisting him, but it was still costing Charmer much effort. A duplicate Mr. Pei was standing by the dig, remonstrating with Charmer as another drone loitered nearby.
I must ask you to desist. You've already brought trouble on yourself by trespassing on our territory and by refusing to cooperate in your detention. Please do not compound matters by performing this unauthorized excavation of Chinese soil.
Charmer dumped a pile of dirt on the side of the trench.
Or what, Mr. Pei? You'll shoot me like you shot the golems. I don't think so. I'm being observed, you know. There are witnesses. We are well aware that others are participating in this severe breach of interplanetary law, Mr. Pei said. Rest assured that the full weight of judicial process will be brought to bear on all offenders. Now, please, desist from this activity.
I'm still here, Gleb said.
Me too,
Sunday added.
So am I, Jeffrey said.
Present,
Jitendra said enthusiastically.
Cozy, isn't it, inside Charmer's helmet?
Mr. Pei looked aside as the two other drones caught up with the third and triangulated themselves around the digging man. There was only one Mr. Pei now. The other figments must have been deemed surplus to requirements.
Ah, he said. The border officials.
A dragon approached, snaking its way through the vacuum as if following the contours of invisible topography. It was crimson and serpentine and abundantly winged and clawed, its face whiskered and vulpine. It belched flames. Some kind of suborbital carrier lodged inside it, a rectangular vehicle with six landing legs and downward-pointing belly thrusters.
Very melodramatic, Mr. Pei, Sunday said. Think nothing of it. It's the very least we can do for our honored foreign guests. It might be an idea to dig a bit faster, Sunday said.
A moment later, she really was back in the apartment, transfixed by a bar of sunlight cutting across the coffee table. Jeffrey, Gleb, and Jitendra were standing there like sleepwalkers, their minds elsewhere. The interlude lasted a second, and then she was back with Charmer.
I dropped out for a moment there, she said. I think they're squeezing bandwidth again. Did anyone else feel it?
For a second, Jeffrey said. I guess we shouldn't count. And then he was gone.
Gleb and Jitendra have disappeared as well, so it's just you and me now, Charmer said, for as long as the quangle holds.
They're taking this more seriously than I expected. Have you hit anything yet?
Charmer didn't answer, too preoccupied with his digging. Mr. Pei looked on, shaking his head disappointedly, as if he could envisage a million more favorable ways that this sequence of events could have unfolded. If only everyone had been reasonable and prepared to bend to the iron will of state authority. The dragon gusted overhead, a slow-motion whip crack. Its wings were leathery and bat-like, and flapped too slowly for such an absurdly vast creature. It arched its neck and roared cartoon flames. Stretching out multiple claws, it landed and quickly gathered itself into a coiled python-like mass. The dragon cloak held for a few seconds, and then dissipated as a ramp lowered down from the angled front of the border enforcement vehicle. Suited figures ducked out, each of them with a rifle-sized weapon gripped two-handed and close to the chest. They came down the ramp in perfect lockstep, like a well-drilled ballet troupe.
I think we've made our point here, Sunday said. Now might be a good time to consider surrendering.
Charmer's spade clanged against something. Sunday felt the jolt all the way through the suit, back through the tangle of ching threads linking the sensorium to her body in the zone.
My God, she said.
Why are you surprised?
I just am. What is discovered on or beneath Chinese soil remains Chinese state property,
Mr. Pei said helpfully. Charmer worked feverishly. He began to uncover whatever it was the spade had hit. Even as the enforcement agents bounded over land from the transporter, they were not cloaked. Their armored suits and weapons were intimidating enough.
Again, I must ask you to desist, Mr. Pei said.
Charmer kept working. The object, whatever it was coming into view. It was a rectangular box lying lengthwise. The drones had moved forward of Mr. Pei, peering down to get a better view. Charma hauled the object out of the trench and set it on the ground, between two piles of excavated soil. It was about the size of a big shoebox, plain metal in construction. Charma's thick-fingered gloves found an opening mechanism with surprising ease, and the lid sprang wide. There was something inside the box, lying loose. Mechanical junk, all gristle and wires.
"I must ask you to stand up now," Mr. Pei said as his officials gathered around Charma.
Charma looked up, taking Sunday's point of view with him.
"It's all right," he said. "You can arrest me now."
"Please relinquish the item," Mr. Pei said.
But Charma was already obeying. He pushed up from his kneeling position, leaving the box and its contents at his feet.
"What now?"
he asked.
"Curtail the Qing bind, please, until you have been debriefed."
"Curtail it yourself," Charma said.
Mr. Pei beckoned to one of the enforcement guards. The faceless guard brought his rifle around with the stock facing away from his body. He went behind Charma's back. Sunday saw the guard loom on the helmet's rear-facing head up, saw the stock swinging in like a mallet. The blow knocked Charma to the ground, stealing the breath from his lungs.
"I'm afraid it will now prove necessary to apply administrative restraint," Mr. Pei said.
Charma pushed back into the kneeling position. Another of the guards came forward, unclipping a device like a miniature fire extinguisher from his belt. The guard aimed the device at Charma, then lowered the muzzle slightly, correcting aim so as not to impact any vulnerable areas of his suit. A silver-white stream hosed against Charma's chest, where the material organized itself into an obscene, flattened starfish shape and began to push exploratory tentacles away from its center of mass, searching for entry points into the suit's inner workings. Charma strove to pour the substance away, but it globbed itself around his fingers and quickly set about working its way up the wrist, moving with a vile, amoeboid eagerness.
"Looks like it's going to be lights out for me in a moment or two," Charma said. "You'll all be good boys and girls until I'm back, won't you?"
There was just time for one of Mr. Pei's guards to bend down and pick up the box. The guard took out the object that had been inside it and held it up for inspection, dangling it between two gloved fingers. Sunday had a second look at it then. She'd been wondering if her eyes had fooled her the first time, but it still looked like junk. And then the Qing bind broke, and she was back in the zone. They were all shaking. Sunday glanced at her friends and wondered why they couldn't keep it together, not look so visibly nervous in front of Gleb. Then she caught the adrenaline tremor in her own hands and knew she was just as culpable.
"It won't take them long to find out who he is," Gleb said. "Chama's not one for rules, but he'd still have to file some kind of flight plan before taking out the hopper."
Sunday exhaled heavily.
"I feel terrible. We should never have got you mixed up in all this."
"Charma took this initiative all on his own. You weren't holding a gun to his head. And it's not as if there wasn't some self-interest involved as well."
"None of which we signed up to," Jeffrey said.
"Shut it, brother. Now is emphatically not the time."
"Sorry," he said, and for a moment appeared willing to hold his tongue. "But look," he went on doggedly, "we didn't ask Charma to put his neck on the line, and now we're worse off than we were before. We still don't know what Eunice buried, and in all likelihood, we never will. And mark my words, this will break system-wide. Exactly how long do you think it'll be before the cousins put two and two together?"
Jitendra's eyes were glazed. "I'm scrolling news feeds. Nothing's breaking yet."
"Because it only happened 5 fucking minutes ago," Jeffrey said.
"Maybe it won't break," Sunday said. "The Chinese don't publicize every incursion. They don't want to give the impression they can't police the ghost wall."
"The policing looked pretty effective from where I was sitting," Jeffrey countered. "And what's with you being an expert on international affairs all of a sudden?"
"No need to be snide, brother. I'm just saying things may not be as bad as you want to make them."
"Let's hope they aren't," Gleb said. "Did you get a good look at whatever was in the box?" Jitendra asked brightly.
as if they'd just turned the conversational page onto a happy new chapter. Sunday shook her head.
Not really. Just a glimpse. Looked like junk, to be honest. Some mechanical thing, like a component from a bigger machine. Could have been one of your robot parts, for all I know.
That's not going to get us very far, Jeffrey said.
Charmer saw more than I did. Maybe it was enough.
Jeffrey put his hands on the table, fingers spread as if he was about to play piano.
Okay, let's take stock here. We just participated in a crime.
Sunday had to admit that the very word had a seductive glamour. To have succeeded in committing a crime, even in the de-scrutinized zone, or from within it at least, was a rare achievement.
Yes, she said. We did. A crime. That makes us criminals.
The word tasted odd in her mouth, like an obscure oath.
But it was a small crime in the scheme of things. No one was hurt. Nothing was damaged. There was no malintent. We just wanted to retrieve something that belonged to us.
Are we definitely safe here, or will the Chinese be able to backtrack the Qing packets? Jeffrey asked.
They're good, Sunday said. But our blind gateways should keep us anonymous. At international level, they could apply for a retroactive data injunction, but I don't think it will come to that. We trespassed, that's all. It's not like we were trying to bring down the state.
She paused and swallowed.
Of course, they could simply ask Charma.
I wonder how long he'd hold out against interrogation, Jeffrey mused. Gleb shot him a look.
Please.
Sorry, but I think we have to ask that question.
Unfortunately, my brother's right, Sunday said. Charma might not be put through anything unpleasant, but there's not much he'll be able to keep from them if they go for full neural intervention. Still, it might not come to that. The Chinese aren't idiots. They won't want to make any more of this than they absolutely have to.
Let's hope, Jeffrey said.
A Qing icon popped into her visual field. Caller, Hector Akinya. Location, Akinya Household, East African Federation, Earth. She groaned. Oh, this couldn't possibly get any better. Now Hector wants a word with me.
Any reason you wouldn't normally take that call? Jeffrey asked.
On the rare occasions when Hector and I need to talk, we usually ching into neutral territory. But it's going to look odd if I don't pick up. Jitendra, go and make some coffee. Gleb, maybe you could help him? Think we could all use some fresh.
As they headed to the kitchen, she voked the figment into being, making sure Jeffrey was able to see it as well. Hector's standing form smiled, taking in his surroundings with something between horror and detached anthropological fascination.
This is a rare privilege, he said. I've seldom had the pleasure of the de-scrutinized zone before, much less your lodgings.
My home, Sunday told him, and you're here under sufferance.
Well, I don't suppose there's any point in being a struggling artist unless you go the full hair shirt. How are you, anyway? And how are you, Jeffrey? We were beginning to become slightly concerned. It's been a while since we heard anything from either of you.
You needn't lose any sleep, Jeffrey said.
Oh, I won't, not at all. Nor will Lucas. He's doing splendidly, by the way, leg healing nicely. And he's no less interested in your welfare than I am. You were going to get around to calling us, weren't you?
I said I'd be doing some sightseeing before returning to Earth, Jeffrey said.
As well you must.
Hector made it sound as if Jeffrey was begging approval for something unspeakably sordid.
But you can also understand our, I won't say anxiety, rather our stringent need to have this matter resolved as speedily and as cleanly as possible.
What matter would that be, cousin?
Sunday asked.
Credit me with at least some intelligence, cousin. Your brother is with you, and we're picking up reports of a diplomatic breach that can be tied to both an associate of yours and a part of the moon that our grandmother had a direct connection with. Do you honestly expect me to dismiss these connections?
You're very good, Hector, Sunday said.
I do my best.
But there's no connection, I'm afraid.
She took a vaulting leap of faith.
Yes, Jeffrey told me about this glove you've all got so worked up about. I made him. But that's an end to it. This, what did you call it? Diplomatic breach? It's got nothing to do with us.
Our sources point to the detention of a close friend of yours.
I've got hundreds of close friends. What they get up to is their own business.
And the coincidence of this friend, his name's Charma Akbulut, by the way, having been arrested close to our grandmother's crash site?
You said it, Hector. Coincidence. And what crash are we talking about, anyway?
Hector made to speak, then tightened his lips and shook his broad, handsome head very slowly. The figment swiveled its baleful, profoundly disappointed gaze onto her brother.
This is all deeply regrettable, Geoffrey. You shouldn't have spoken to your sister. That in itself is a clear violation of our arrangement.
My brother's a lousy liar, Sunday said. But the fault's yours for sending him here under false pretenses in the first place. And whatever promise you made to him, you better keep it.
That will depend on the safe return of the glove and your full and open cooperation henceforth, Hector replied.
You'll get your damned glove, Geoffrey said.
Hector nodded once.
I expect nothing less. But I meant what I just said, and it applies equally to you, Sunday. Lucas and I demand complete transparency.
The figment vanished. Sunday stared at the part of the room where Hector had been, feeling as if she was still being watched by a malevolent presence.
You could have declined the ching, Gleb said, sidling back in from the kitchen.
And make it look like we have something to hide?
Jitendra was carrying in the coffee. Though her nerves wouldn't thank her for it, Sunday gladly accepted one of the steaming mugs.
No, I had to take the bind.
Her brother scratched at his curls. I wonder how Hector found out so quickly.
Like he said, sources. We do business with the Chinese, so why shouldn't Hector have a friend or two on the other side of the ghost wall? For all we know, this goes all the way up to Mr. Pei.
Do you think we should call anyone?
Gleb asked.
I mean, my husband's just been arrested.
Sunday's stomach kinked tighter. Charma was her friend, but Gleb was facing the arrest and detention of the person he most loved in the universe. They'd been together a long time, the zookeepers, and their marriage was as strong as any she knew. Even when she tried to imagine Jitendra being in the same position as Charma, she didn't think it could be compared to what Gleb was going through now. As cold as that made her feel, it was the truth. Then again, Charma had a history of this kind of thing, so for that matter to Gleb. She heard footsteps outside, clanging up the external staircase.
It can't be the authorities, she said quietly. There's nothing to tie any of us back to the border incident.
Unless, Jitendra said, your cousin decided to spread the news.
Geoffrey buried his face in his hands.
This was a mistake from the word go.
Show some spine, brother. We can't be arrested or extradited without due process, and we're not the ones in deep shit on the other side of the ghost wall.
Someone knocked. Sunday thought she recognized the rhythm.
Open up, please,
she heard a woman demand in a voice she also knew. She set down her coffee and composed herself. Easy to toss out assurances about not being arrested, but she wasn't nearly as certain about that in her own mind. Pissing on Chinese territorial sovereignty was a fairly big deal. It was entirely possible that the usual protocols would be suspended. She opened the door to a woman in a high-collared blouse and long formal skirt, wearing a face Sunday didn't know.
It's June, the face announced.
How do I know for sure?
You don't, but let me in anyway.
Sunday admitted the proxy, shutting the door behind it. The face melted like a Dali clock. When it reconfigured, Sunday was looking at June Wing, chinging a plexus claybot, similar to the prototype Sunday had puppeted on Earth.
This isn't going to be a social call, is it? Sunday said.
The claybot adjusted its skirt as it sat down.
Things have come to a pretty pass, if you don't mind my saying so.
Precisely what was Charma Akbulut doing behind the ghost wall?
The less you know about that, the better, Jitendra said. I'll ask again in that case.
Sunday looked at Jitendra, at Gleb and her brother, then back to the golem. The knot in her stomach was now so tangled that it could have supplied a topologist with an entire thesis. She was astonished word had got around as quickly as it had.
but then she supposed she shouldn't have been. Just as there were commercial interests between Akinia Space and China, so Plexus had its affiliations, its insider contacts. Digging for something that belongs to us, she said, to my family, no one else's business. And this was a spur-of-the-moment thing, was it? And why was Chama doing the digging, not you?
Chama took unilateral, Gleb began.
Because he seeks to put you in debt to him, June Wing snapped. Yes, I know Chama's methods. Brazen and... what's the opposite of risk-averse? Foolhardy to the point of suicidal.
The Chinese won't want a diplomatic storm on their hands, Jitendra said.
No, June Wing agreed, and that's presently about the only thing you've got in your favor.
Sunday said,
my family will intervene.
Only if there's a direct threat to your liberty, and perhaps not even then, June Wing said with icy plausibility. As for Chama, why should they lift a finger to help him?
If it's a matter of keeping a family secret buried, maybe they'll do just that, Gleb said.
The golem nodded keenly. Yes, and optimism is a fine and wonderful thing and should be strenuously encouraged in the young. But my understanding is that Chama's actions haven't brought anything useful to light.
You know a lot, Jeffrey said.
I'm June Wing, she answered,
as if this was all the explanation any reasonable person could require.
Then they'll have to let Chama go, Gleb said. They can't hold him just for digging up some soil.
There was something in that box, Sunday pointed out.
I saw it myself. Junk, most likely, but not nothing. And who knows what it meant to Eunice or what the Chinese might think it means.
This is what will happen, June Wing said in a firm, taking charge tone that brooked no dissension. We will allow the Chinese time to respond, a day at the very least, perhaps three. If there are no encouraging overtures from the Ghost Wall, then we will explore avenues of subtle commercial persuasion.
That'll work? Jeffrey asked.
Only if they don't feel cornered. They use Plexus machines, billions of them, supplied and maintained under very competitive terms. They won't be in a hurry to jeopardize that arrangement.
And I doubt very much that Plexus would throw away a lucrative contract just to save a friend of a friend, said Jeffrey, drawing a glare from Sunday, who didn't think he was helping matters.
It wouldn't come to that, June Wing replied evenly. But both parties have a vested interest in maintaining cordial relations.
What worries me, Sunday said, is what we're going to owe you for getting Chama out of trouble.
All you need to worry about is keeping your family in check, Sunday. Leave this to me, and there will be a satisfactory outcome. But if Akinia Space barge in with threats and sanctions, don't expect Plexus to dig you out of the hole.
Sunday shook her head.
I have no say over the cousins, I'm afraid. We'll just have to hope that Hector bought my story and doesn't think there's a connection between Chama and the glove, about which you've told me nothing.
One thing at a time, June, Sunday answered. June Wing made to reply, or at least looked on the cusp of answering, but then her face froze, paralyzing into stiffness. The golem sat before them, posture waxwork rigid. All sense of life had deserted the claybot.
June? Jitendra asked.
Chingbind must have snapped, Sunday said.
June's outside the zone. Could the Chinese be blocking the quangle?
Nothing yet, crude, but you've already seen what they're capable of, Gleb answered.
The face shifted, regained animus. The claybot's clothes morphed and recolored. Now they were looking at a man of indeterminate age and ethnicity, dressed in a sea-green satin suit. His face was strikingly bland and unmemorable, like some mathematical average of all human male faces. His skin pallor was an unrealistic pearl gray, unlike any actual flesh tone seen outside of a mortuary. The pupilless voids of his large dark eyes were thumb holes punched through a mask.
You don't know me, he said, smiling benignly, but I think we're about to get better acquainted.
Who are you? Sunday said. And what the fuck are you doing interrupting my conversation?
Expediency,
the man said, offering the palms of his hands.
A Jingbind was open,
a quangled path allocated, rather than go through the frankly tiresome rigmarole of opening a second, I decided to make use of what already existed.
I thought our comms were supposed to be secure, Jitendra said.
Ish, the man answered after a moment, his smile disclosing a toothless, tongueless emptiness of a mouth.
It's the bans, Jeffrey said, directing a statement at Gleb. Isn't it?
You already told me the pans have the ability to manipulate Quangle traffic under everyone's noses.
It's possible, Gleb said, as if it was the answer he feared the most.
I call myself Truro, the man said, and yes, in a capacity that would be too tedious to presently explain, I do speak for the Panspermian Initiative.
He's lagged, Sunday said quietly. I've been watching his reactions. He's trying to get the jump on what we say, but he's not quite good enough to hide it completely. Must be chinging in from Earth or near-Earth space.
My present whereabouts needn't detain us, Truro said. But I congratulate you on your perspicacity.
What do you want with us? Sunday asked. If Gleb knew this man, he wasn't saying.
Nothing. Precisely that. Which is to say, I want you to do nothing. And say nothing. I can't stress the importance of that. I am aware of your predicament. How could I not be when Chama Akbulut is one of us? And steps are already being taken to ameliorate the situation.
I think we've got things covered. Thanks, Jeffrey said.
And I think you misunderstand the degree to which you are already embroiled. Chama has taken this action at considerable risk to himself, in terms of both physical harm and incarceration. Surely you understand that his selflessness places you in a position of indebtedness.
Chama didn't ask us first, Jeffrey said.
He's right, Gleb put in. Chama did this off his own back. None of us would have agreed to it, me included.
Nonetheless, Truro said, clearly unfazed by this line of argument. You could hardly have expected Chama to behave otherwise when presented with the facts as they stood.
You mean by sharing a secret with him, we encouraged him to do this? Sunday asked.
Knowing his character, you must have understood there was an excellent chance of it. Besides, when the opportunity arose, you all endorsed his actions by accompanying him to the Ghost Wall.
We weren't endorsing anything, Jitendra spluttered. We were trying to talk him out of it.
Until the very end?
We were concerned for his welfare, Sunday said. We tried to observe him for as long as we could.
Still, a debt has been incurred. Chama and Gleb don't speak for the entire initiative, but they were right to recognize the importance of Jeffrey's work in regard to their own.
Truro scanned the room, still wearing his black gash of a smile.
We have leverage. The Chinese have been feeling history's cold breath down their necks for decades. They've had their century and a half in the sun, the capstone to 3,000 years of uninterrupted statehood. They did wonderful and glorious things, but now what? India has risen, and now it's Africa's turn. The wheels roll on. The problem is, a state like that doesn't turn on a dime. The Chinese need a new direction. So what they're doing is returning to what they were always best at. Thinking long-term, devising grand imperial ambitions. Needless to say, the Panspermian Initiative hasn't escaped their attention. The green efflorescence is exactly the kind of life-swallowing enterprise they can really sink their teeth into. Of all the dry and sky member states, China has always had the most cordial relations with the United Aquatic Nations.
How does this help us? Jeffrey asked.
Simply put, We are very anxious not to offend the Chinese, and they are very anxious not to offend us. You never know, we might be working together for an awfully long time. Either way, everyone's being extremely careful about the next move, anxious not to do the slightest thing that might jeopardize future maneuvers. Which is why Chama's little expedition is causing so many difficulties, but not, I hope, insurmountable ones.
You said we should do nothing, Sunday said.
Very soon, like clockwork, word will reach the relevant border authorities that Chama is to be shown unusual clemency. He will be released, and the whole sorry business put behind us.
He leaned forward with particular urgency.
But the machinery of negotiation is delicate. The wrong intervention from Akinya's space or plexus could derail the whole process. Perhaps catastrophically. You do want to see your friend again, don't you? With his memories still more or less intact? Then do nothing.
You'd better be right about this, Jeffrey said.
I'm never wrong,
Truro replied. And now he was looking at Jeffrey and only Jeffrey.
I'll be in touch, Mr. Akinya, about the elephants. I'm sure we have a long and fruitful relationship ahead of us.
The golem wilted. It slumped for a moment until invisible strings jerked it back into life. The face danced through preloaded permutations, the clothes and hair shimmering and squirming with a slurping rustle. Then June Wing was back in the room.
Something outrageous just happened, she said.
June Wing, it was clear, was not a woman accustomed to being hijacked. The robot proctors of the African Lunar Administration had the grey and steel sheen of expensive Swedish cutlery. Their helmets were chromed, their faces blank black fencing masks. They would not kill, but they packed myriad non-lethal modes of enforcement. Many of these were exquisitely unpleasant, quite liable to cause long-lasting damage to the central nervous system.
"Which one of you is Gleb Ozerov?"
asked the first, the synthesized voice booming out of its meshwork face.
"That'll be me," Gleb answered timorously.
"Gleb Ozerov, you are charged with the care of this individual under lunar law. Indicate compliance."
"I comply," Gleb said. "I most definitely comply, thank you. That'll be fine."
There was rather more to it than that, of course, but the additional terms of Chama's release were packed into a lengthy, clause-ridden org summary that his husband had already read and acknowledged before the handover. Given the scope of possible repercussions, there was no denying that they had all got off lightly. After 8 hours of detention and debriefing, Chama had been shipped back to Cope Town by suborbital vehicle and released into the custody of the proctors. The robots had taken him to the railway station and onto the next available train. Chama was still standing meekly between his captors when Sunday, Jeffrey, Jitendra and Gleb met him at the tram terminal. "Wow," Sunday had breathed. "You really mean business. I've never even seen proctors before. I don't think they even assemble the fuckers until they're wanted somewhere."
"They were scary," Jeffrey said.
"That was the idea," Sunday answered. Once the boilerplate had been stripped away, the terms looked generous. No charges had been issued against Chama, although he had been given a formal warning, which would remain on file until well into the next century. He was forbidden from entering Chinese territory on the moon, or anywhere else in the system for another decade. Furthermore, he was required to remain in the de-scrutinized zone for the next 100 days, a form of soft detention that also forbade the use of passive Qing or embodiment. Communications with any individual outside the zone would be subjected to routine machine and human interception and analysis. Beyond that, Chama was technically free. Sunday harbored some qualms about going to meet Chama, fearing that it tied her too closely to the border incident. Jitendra insisted she had nothing to fear. "If Chama got into this without us being involved," Jitendra said, "we'd still have been dragged into it by now. We're his friends."
I hope you're right.
Of course he's right, Gleb said. But thanks for being there anyway. I didn't much care for those proctors.
None of us did, Sunday said.
Charmer had precious little to say in the minutes after the handover. Perhaps he couldn't quite believe he wasn't still in custody. Charmer's release and his return to the zone had been played out in the full public gaze of the surveilled world. Charmer might only have had a small number of close friends, but he was familiar to hundreds of his fellow citizens, and they all wanted to know why he'd been dumped at the tram station by the evil-looking robots. By the time they reached the queue at the taxi stand, they were fending off inquiries from all corners. Well-wishers even began to ching in, a ghost crowd clotting around Charmer and his friends, like a gathering haze of cold, dark matter.
This won't make things any easier with Hector and Lucas, Jeffrey said as the taxi barged through midtown traffic.
Fuck 'em,
Sunday said.
Hector was only calling to gloat. It's not like he was ever going to lift a finger to help.
They'll still give me a hard time when I get back.
So start working on your story. You found a glove, that's all. If Hector and Lucas want to think there's a connection to what happened in Pythagoras, that's their problem. We don't have to help them along the way.
What about these? Jitendra asked, opening his fist to reveal the colored gems. Do they go back with Jeffrey or not?
Sunday reached over Jitendra's shoulder and scooped them into her palm.
They stay with me. You weren't even meant to take them out of the apartment.
We're all here, Jitendra said. I was worried about someone turning the place over while we were out.
Oh, Sunday said,
her unhappy tone indicating that was a possibility she hadn't even considered. Jeffrey and Jitendra were up front, Sunday, Charmer, and Gleb in the rear. Charmer was still wearing the hard-shelled spacesuit with the helmet cradled in his lap. He had his arms around it, chin resting on the bulbous crown. The Chinese had given the suit a thorough clean. It spangled with showroom freshness.
Looks like they were thorough, Jeffrey said.
Charmer's head bobbed in the neck ring.
Enough. And I don't suppose they changed their minds about letting you keep anything you dug up out there?
Sunday said. Charmer looked regretful.
I didn't push my luck. They were doing me a big enough favor by letting me go.
It was never going to work, Jeffrey said. What did we actually get out of this except a close encounter with border security, a debt to pay back to Truro, and a few grey hairs?
That's for you to figure out.
Charmer rolled the helmet over and dug into its open neck.
Here, make of it what you will.
He passed something to Sunday. It was a stiff, off-white cylinder like a section of bamboo. It took her a moment to realize it was paper, rolled up tight and bound with a rubber band. Sunday snapped off the rubber band and carefully unwound the scroll. It was a collection of pages, a dozen or so, coiled loosely together. The paper felt delicate, ready to crumble at the least provocation. The text was in English. She could tell that much from the words, although the sentences were difficult to parse. Even when her eyes dropped a Swahili translation filter over the page, it still didn't make much sense.
Is there some significance to this?
She asked, leafing through the pages.
You tell me, Charmer said. That was the only thing in the box.
Jeffrey looked around the taxi. We know what was in the box, Charmer. We saw it. It was some junk. Not a roll of paper. We'd have known if we saw a roll of paper. Charmer sighed.
The junk was for the Chinese. Figured they'd confiscate anything I turned up in that ditch, so I took something along with me. By the time you chinged into my sense space, I'd already opened the box once, swapped the paper for the junk. Didn't you notice that I got it open very easily the second time, as if I knew exactly what to do?
You couldn't have known that was going to work, Jeffrey said.
You don't get very far in life if you're not prepared to take a few chances. So I had to be able to open the box and switch the contents without the drones getting a good look at what I was doing. Wasn't all that hard, though, because the drones didn't want to get too close. Not with them being basically nuclear-powered missiles and me a fragile human in a spacesuit on the surface of the fucking moon.
Okay, Sunday said, accepting this explanation for the moment.
I can see how you might have switched the junk, and I can see how the Chinese would have confiscated the junk as if it was the thing inside the box all the time. But I can't believe they didn't spot the paper afterwards when you are being debriefed. Oh, they did. But I told them. I had it on me all the while. Said it was a keepsake. A lucky charm. Just a roll of paper, after all. Why would they doubt me? Why would they expect someone to have dug up some old papers on the moon?
Damn lucky, Jeffrey said. You couldn't have known there was paper in that box.
Damn lucky, absolutely. Anyhow, regardless of what I'd found, the switch still bought me a little time to examine whatever was inside. Chinese confiscated the box straight off. Didn't get round to searching my suit until 2 hours later, when I was in their holding tank. Even if they had taken whatever was in the box, I'd still have had plenty of time to examine it.
According to the print at the top of the odd-numbered pages, the sheets had been liberated from a copy of Gulliver's Travels. After a few moments' mental searching, Sunday remembered the scattering, how Memphis had reminded them of that being one of Eunice's favourite books, one she liked to read under the acacia trees near the household.
"Course, that wouldn't necessarily have helped," Chalmers said, as if he had a hotline into Sunday's head. "I mean, I'm assuming those pages mean something specific to you Akinyas, something way over my head."
"Eunice liked to read it," Jeffrey said. "That's all. It ties the paper to her, but beyond that..."
"She buried it for a reason," Sunday said. "You did well, Chama, to sneak this out under the noses of the Chinese. That took some doing."
"I thought so," Chama said. "But it doesn't get us anywhere," Jeffrey said.
"Yet,"
Sunday corrected.
"We still need to run it by the construct, see what she makes of it. We can also run tests on the paper, check whether there's something on it we can't see right now. Invisible ink, microdots, secret codes worked into the text, that kind of thing. Or maybe something in the words themselves."
"Have fun. Tomorrow I'm on my way back to Africa. Visa runs out in the afternoon, and I'm not going to push my luck for the sake of a few hours.
So you're just leaving this with me?"
Jeffrey looked back, surprised at her question. "Do what you want with it. I'll back you all the way.
In mind, if not in body."
"I can't be in two places at once. If I start chinging up here at every opportunity, the cousins will really start wondering what's going on. And we don't want that, do we?"
"No,"
Sunday said, with reluctance.
"That we don't. But you should be ready for whatever Eunice throws at you,"
Chalmers said.
"She's taken you from Earth to the moon. Do you honestly think she meant you to stop there?"
"My sister has to pay the rent as well," Jeffrey said. "She can play Eunice's little game up to a point. But at some point, reality has to kick in. We both have day jobs. And in case you got the wrong impression, neither of us has buckets of money to throw around."
"Then dinner's on me,"
Chalmers said grandly. "That's only fair, isn't it? I feel like celebrating. It's not every day you become a pawn in international relations." So they went out that night, the five friends, to a good place that did East African and Indian, and when they had finished two courses and finally fended off the last of the inquisitive well-wishers, eager to congratulate Chama on his safe return, Sunday took out the cylinder of rolled paper, snapped it free of its rubber band, and spread it carefully on a part of the table as yet unblemished by food and wine spillages. Two full wine bottles served as weights to stop the pages curling back into a tube.
"I think I have it," she said,
hardly daring to voice her suspicion aloud for fear that it would strike the others as foolish.
"The fact that this is Gulliver's Travels isn't the only thing tying the book to Eunice."
Jeffrey sounded wary but curious. "Go on."
"When you get back home, I want you to confirm that these pages really were ripped from the copy of the book in the household archive. I'm betting they were, though. I'm also betting that Eunice picked this part of the book very deliberately. It's a signpost, telling us where to look next."
"Which would be..." Jitendra asked. Sunday sucked in a breath.
"I have to go to Mars, or rather the moons of Mars.
That's the point, you see. Chama looked up from the third course he had ordered while the others were on their seconds. Gulliver went to Mars? I don't remember that part.
That was Robinson Crusoe, Gleb said firmly. At least, I think he was on Mars. Otherwise, why would there be a city there named after him?
The point, Sunday said, before the conversation drifted irrevocably off course, is that Gulliver met the Laputan astronomers on their flying island, and the astronomers showed Gulliver their instruments and told him that there were two moons going around Mars.
Which is sort of unremarkable, given that there are two moons going around Mars, Jitendra said, with the slow, befuddled air of a man in deep surrender to intoxication. He picked up one of the wine bottles, causing the pages to revert to a tight, off-white tube. Sunday gritted her teeth and pushed on.
This was before anyone knew of the real moons. Swift took a guess. Even put in their orbits and periods. Didn't get them right, of course, but, you know, give the man credit for trying.
And you think this is the clue? Geoffrey asked.
I ran it by the construct. She agrees with me.
You made her, Geoffrey said. That's maybe not too surprising.
Sunday deployed a fierce frown. She's perfectly capable of shooting my theories down in flames, brother. This time she thinks I'm on the right lines.
Mars is a big planet, Gleb mused. Where are you going to start?
The clue indicates the moons, so that's where I'll look. And we can rule out Deimos immediately. Eunice was never there. Which leaves Phobos, Chama said. Fear to Deimos's panic. Are you really sure you want to go to a chunk of rock named Fear?
Jitendra was recharging their glasses. It could be called Happy Smiley Fun Moon, and it wouldn't make it any easier to get to. Look, it's a nice idea, all this adventuring, but we need to be realistic. We can't afford Mars.
I could go on my own, Sunday said.
And that suddenly makes it achievable?
Jitendra shook his head, smiling with a supercilious air of the only grown-up in the room.
This is out of our league, I'm afraid. You have commissions to finish. I have research to complete for June Wing. We can't afford to let people down, not when we've got bills to pay.
Sunday was not proud of herself, but she pouted anyway. Bills can fuck off.
And so can Eunice, Geoffrey replied. Even if she planted clues all over the system, she obviously did it decades ago. What difference does it make if we follow this up now or wait a few years?
Oh, brother, you really don't get it, do you?
She was shaking her head, stabbing her finger on the table.
This is life, not a dress rehearsal. If we don't do this now, we may as well start planning our own funerals. I don't want to be sensible and prudent. Being sensible and prudent is for assholes like Hector and Lucas. We turned away from all that. Don't you realize? We wanted life, surprises, risk, not stocks and shares and tedious fucking boardroom meetings about the cost of importing ice from fucking Neptune.
Realizing that she was getting loud, drawing glances from across the restaurant, she dialed down her voice.
That's not the life for me, all right? Maybe you've changed your mind. I haven't. And if I have to find a way to get to Mars, I will.
Geoffrey gave her his most infuriating calm down nod. All right. I get it. I really do. And although you may not believe me, I agree. But if we do this, we have to do it together, a shared risk. We mustn't rush into it.
You've spent your whole life not rushing into things.
He shrugged off the barb. Maybe I have, Sunday, but I'm serious. If you insist on going to Mars, then I want to be part of that. She's my grandmother too. But we do it on our terms, without begging favors from anyone. The cousins promised to pay me pretty well for coming to the moon, and there's more funding to follow. If I can find a way to channel some of that into a ticket to Mars, even two tickets, I will. But I'll need time to make it happen. And the last thing I want to do is give them even more reason to get suspicious. He paused, absently picking at the edge of the wine bottle label. If that means waiting months, even a year, so be it.
There's a favorable conjunction right now, Sunday said. Mars is never closer, the crossing never easier.
What goes around comes around, Geoffrey answered.
Thank you. I think I have at least a basic grasp of orbital mechanics.
Jitendra took her hand.
Maybe Jeffrey's right, you know. No one's saying we should forget about all this. But a year, 2 years, what difference will that make, given how long these clues must have been sitting around?
Jeffrey nodded keenly. Whatever we do, we shouldn't act right. Whatever we do, we shouldn't act right now. That'll be the worst possible thing if we want to keep Hector and Lucas off our backs. Once I'm home, I'll give them the glove, and in a few weeks they'll have forgotten all about it. Trust me on this. They don't have the imaginations to think further ahead than that. Not unless money's involved.
Let the trail go cold, then strike, she asked.
Exactly. She sensed displeasure and relief that she had come round to his way of thinking. In the meantime, it will give us all the opportunity to think things over. We really don't know what we're getting into here. Today we escaped, but we were lucky, and we won't necessarily be lucky next time. We may think we know Eunice, but this could just as easily be her way of having a good laugh at our idiocy from beyond the grave or burial site.
She went to a lot of trouble to put that box under Pythagoras, Sunday said. Whatever was motivating her then, it wasn't just spite. And she won't be sending us to Mars out of spite either. She knows only family could get into that vault. She might want to test us, but she won't want to hurt us.
You hope, Jeffrey said.
I know this woman, brother, as well as anyone alive.
And in that moment, she felt more certain of that than anything else in the universe. She woke in the middle of the night, Jitendra's form cool and blue-dappled next to hers. They had made love when her brother was asleep in the next room, and then she had fallen into deep, dreamless oblivion until something caused her to stir. For once, the world beyond her apartment was almost silent. Through the wall, she heard Jeffrey snoring softly. From somewhere below, two or three stacks under her module, a shred of conversation reached her ears. Something clicked in the air circulator. There was a muted gurgle from the plumbing. From a block away came the shriek of a cat, a distant urban hum underpinning everything like the engines in the basement of reality. Sunday slid out of bed, mindful not to disturb Jitendra. Conscious that her brother might wake at any moment, she wrapped a patterned sheet around herself. She passed through the living room, through the clutter left over after their return from the restaurant. More wine, scarlet-stained glasses, bottles of beer. Charma and Gleb had come back to the apartment before returning to their own quarters. Though the conversation had hit some rapids, it had all ended cordially enough. They were friends, after all. In fact, they had spent the rest of the evening trading musical instruments, Jeffrey turning out to be surprisingly nimble-fingered on her battered old cora, Charma astonishing them all by being able to bash out some desert blues on a dusty old acoustic guitar left in one corner of her studio by a former tenant. Then they had watched some cricket, drunk more wine, and the zookeepers had bidden them farewell, and not long after that, Jeffrey had turned in weary and anxious about his trip back to Earth. From the clutter to her studio, she closed the door behind her and moved to the commissioned pieces, the slender white figures, the ones they now wanted redone in black. She stroked their hard-worn contours, feeling the electric tingle of hours of accumulated work. The boundary between art and kitsch was negotiable, even porous. In the right setting, the right context, these pieces might have some questionable integrity. But she knew very well where they would end up, black or white, flanking the doorway to an ethnic restaurant that couldn't even be bothered to decide which part of Africa it was supposed to be parodying. Indifference sharpened to hate. She hated the hours of her life this commission had robbed from her. She loathed it for the true art it had prevented her from creating. She despised it for the path it put her on for the future. She still liked to think she had ambition. Churning out emblematic crap for brainless clients was no part of that. It was easy to take one commission here, another there, just to pay the rent. Too much of that, though. She might as well stop calling herself an artist. In a moment of self-directed spite, she raised her hand to smash the sculptures, but she stilled herself, not caring to wake Jitendra or Jeffrey.
That's you in a nutshell, she thought. You can't stand what you have to do to stay afloat, but you don't have the nerve to actually do anything about it. You do shit jobs to pay the rent, and you only get to eat in nice restaurants when Charma and Gleb are footing the bill. You're as much a prisoner of money as if you'd chosen to work for the family business after all. You just kid yourself that you've escaped. You might laugh at your brother, scold him for his unadventurousness, but at least he has his elephants.
In the morning, they were up early to see him off, groggy-eyed and fog-headed from the night before. Jeffrey was tense about going back to Coketown, back to the Central African Bank. He had to do so, though. According to the current narrative, the glove was still in the vault. If he wasn't seen to return to the branch, his story would unravel at the first awkward question from the cousins.
You'll do fine, she told him.
He nodded, less convinced of this than she was. I have to go into the vault, come out again, that's all. And the bank won't think this is funny behavior?
It's none of their business, brother. Why should they care?
They accompanied Jeffrey to the terminal, kissed him goodbye. She watched her brother speed back to the surveilled world and reflected on the lie she had just told him. Because the last thing he had asked her was to promise that she wouldn't do anything rash.